from KQED. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Rachel Miro in for Mina Kim. In a world grown entirely dependent on the internet, it's worth asking, how are we doing? Is the internet a net win? The question may seem moot given how utterly dependent on it we are, but entrepreneur and CNN columnist Andrew Keen asks us to take a second look and consider who's winning and who's losing in this brave new world. He's written a new book called The Internet Is Not the Answer, in which he argues the internet has been an epic failure, or at the very least, not the answer promised by online evangelists. That's coming up in this hour of Forum. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Rachel Miro in for Mina Kim. Sharing scientific research has never been easier. Nor has shopping. Keeping up with grandma on Facebook is a breeze, but so is stalking your ex. If you live in a democracy, you can find out more about how your government runs things than ever before. But now the government is watching you, too, as it never has before. There is little question the internet has transformed the world, but is it a net positive? Columnist and author Andrew Keen argues not. In his new book, The Internet Is Not the Answer, but rather a force for evil in the form of increased unemployment, inequity, and worse. Andrew Keen, thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Rachel.
So you've written more than one book now decrying the internet. Was there a time you believed that it held great promise for us?
Yeah, and I have to say that I'm not necessarily saying that the internet is a force for evil. I think that might be
Stretching it a bit.
Yeah, a slight exaggeration. Absolutely, and I still believe in it. I'm still an entrepreneur. I still do a lot of stuff on the web. I was, a while ago in the mid-90s, an internet startup entrepreneur. I had a startup called Audio Cafe. So I've been in this business right from the beginning. And in my first book, Cult of the Amateur, which came out in 2007, I described my own particular epiphany, my shift from being an internet optimist to a pessimist.
That's when your faith turned to bitter disappointment?
Well, it's when I began to realize that the promise of the internet, which was about creating new rules, reinventing the world, changing everything, bringing more justice, giving more opportunity to everyone, wasn't actually happening. And what had happened was that the internet was just more of the same, dominated by a tiny clique, mostly of white men, very wealthy men, very well-connected men, smart. These aren't aristocrats. They deserve in some ways to be wealthy. They deserve to be successful. But I realized that the internet wasn't doing what its most idealistic founders, guys like Tim Berners-Lee, Kevin Kelly, what these people believed it was going to do. Kelly said that we would have new rules for the new economy. John Perry Barlow authored a manifesto from cyberspace saying everything's going to be different. This is the new world. This is the new opportunity. In many ways, using language like the discovery of America. And I've begun to realize more and more, and particularly in this new book, that that's not the case. In fact, if anything, what the internet is doing is compounding many of the most troubling features and forces of our early 21st century world.
I suppose you could say we were venal before the internet. It turns out we're venal after.
Venal meaning what?
Venal meaning everything. Our best and worst qualities as a species come out on the internet as they did beforehand. You know, capitalism was red and tooth and claw before the internet. We had fascism and genocide before the internet. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I think, again, I'm careful with words like venal and evil. But I would say that the internet is a mirror. What I would say is we've created this thing that reflects us in an exaggerated way. And the idea of a mirror, of course, given the amount of narcissism on the internet and the way in which the cultural element today is increasingly dominated by what I call in my book a selfie economy, is very troubling. So in a sense, when we look at the internet, we're seeing ourselves. Some people idealize that. Some people, I think, are too dark. I mean, they really do use words like venal and evil. I try to be honest. And when we see this thing, what we're actually seeing is us at our very best and our very worst. And there's a lot of wonderful things on the internet. I think people's generosity, I think the ability to communicate, all those things are good. But I don't think we can ignore the darker elements.
It seems like you're arguing as well that the internet is not so much a frictionless platform as it is an amplifier. So those things, both bad and good, get amplified.
Yeah, I can't remember the name of the book, but the idea of a frictionless platform or medium was, of course, one of the buzz terms of the 90s. I'm sure I read all sorts of books about how this was going to be frictionless. We idealized the idea, for example, of disintermediation, of doing away with curators like yourself. So that the internet would be a place that I would broadcast. But if I was broadcasting this on my own, I would be telling the world how wonderful the book is and getting everyone to buy it. Of course, I'm doing that also. But having someone like yourself to keep me honest, to ask intelligent questions, is one of the most important elements, I think, of old media, which is being swept away by this new media.
And yet here we are having this conversation on a legacy platform, as it were. I mean, I guess it goes to show some people are surviving.
Yeah, but let's face it, Rachel, this is not a for-profit legacy platform. If this was purely for-profit, we may not be here. And it's no coincidence that the old media that's doing best in this new world are NPR platforms, which are publicly supported in some way, is The Guardian newspaper, which I think is excellent, which is supported by a non-profit fund. The pure market-driven media operations are struggling. I mean, even the New York Times is struggling. Even the New York Times is trying still to figure out how it can become a real business in the digital age. So I don't think NPR is an example one way or the other. I'm delighted that NPR exists. I'm delighted it will survive. But its survival in the digital world does not tell us that the internet is itself a success.
You've been a student of the digital world pretty much for its recent history. I'm thinking, what now, at least 25 years you've participated in it as an entrepreneur. Do you see a way forward that we could take that others haven't taken until now?
Absolutely. I don't think we have any choice. We can't go back. I'm not a nostalgist. I'm not saying
you're not a Luddite.
I'm certainly not a Luddite, although, you know, in my book I write about Luddism and suggest that it's not in itself a bad thing. I think it's a human reaction to the dramatic impact of technology on people's lives. But I don't think we have any choice in going back. The digital world is the key event. In fact, I write in my book about 1989 when Tim Berners-Lee invented the World Wide Web. In 89, we all thought that the fall of the Berlin Wall was the critical event of the end of the 20th century that would result in the end of history. Actually, 1989, I think historians will look back at not as the end of history, but the beginning of a new kind of history, a beginning of digital history, the foundation of the web and Berners-Lee's remarkable invention. But I think that we have to acknowledge that this is not just about technology. It's about economics, politics, culture. We have to understand, and that's why my book really focuses on the historical element of this. We have to understand that we're living through something as profound, as challenging, as remarkable as the first industrial revolution. And we have to understand that the first industrial revolution of the early 19th, mid-19th century only worked because it was regulated, because the government did intervene. Had we not had any kind of intervention, any kind of regulation, 14-year-olds would still be working in factories. Our cities would be places which would be so smoggy we wouldn't be able to go out. So I think one of the key polemical targets in my book is this invidious libertarianism that tends to pervade a lot of the tech community and some of its most intelligent leaders, people who believe that the market is the solution, that if only the government can keep out, the internet will succeed. Well, the less the government, the less regulation there is in this digital economy. The wealthier Silicon Valley entrepreneurs become, the more powerful their companies become. But I think the more impoverished in many ways we become.
Well, it's interesting. The arguments you make have parallels. In the late 19th century, there was social Darwinism, you know, the argument that those who are succeeding from merit, for meritorious reasons, and it took decades. It took decades of the labor activists and muckrakers in journalism and people like Teddy Roosevelt to force regulation on the Wild West that American industry had become. What do you see fomenting that regulation, that movement towards a rational approach of governance now?
We're seeing it in lots of different ways. Michael Ignatieff, the Canadian politician, excellent sort of social commentator, says we need a new Bismarck in our digital age. I'm not sure I would go that far, but of course Bismarck was the person who, in many ways, even if he was a conservative, instituted the first kind of welfare state in Germany in the late part of the 19th century. What we're seeing now on lots of different fronts, though, is the battle over how this new digital operating system will work. So, for example, Uber, which I write about in some detail in the book, Uber is a classic case. Should Uber be allowed to hire anyone they want? Should we want to sit in a cab that's being driven by someone who's just got out of jail or someone who's guilty of all sorts of sex crimes? Same with Airbnb. Should this be regulated so that when you rent out your home, that home is at least secure, you have insurance, and that the people who rent their homes out are obliged to pay taxes? Should Google be regulated? Google is the new Microsoft. If anything, it's even more powerful than Microsoft ever was. Google is so powerful on so many fronts that it's using some of its businesses to promote others, which I think is one very good reason to investigate it on the antitrust front, which is exactly what's happening in Europe and perhaps will happen in America. So on lots of different fronts, Amazon's treatment of labor, this new sort of explosion of drones in terms of security and how people use them. And of course, above all else, the whole issue of data. What protection do we have as we store ourselves on the network, as our whole identity is rooted in our data, as we indeed become data? What protection do we have both against government and against private companies? Edward Snowden, I think, did a very good job exposing the problems of this. Snowden's exposure wasn't just about the NSA. It was about the collusion between large Silicon Valley companies and the NSA. So these are all huge issues that aren't going to be dealt with or solved in 6 months or a year, but these are the core issues of the early 21st century. They will determine the quality of our life. They'll determine social and economic justice.
Well, I'd like to take you up on that, especially regarding Edward Snowden. But first, let me put the call out to our listeners. If you've got a phone at the handy, 866-733-6786. And now that you're ready, 866-733-6786. You can also email us at forum@kqed.org, and we'll get your questions and thoughts and comments on the air. So you mentioned Edward Snowden and this question of who's doing the regulating. There are people in Congress with criminal records, let alone Uber drivers, and there are people who have had positive experiences with Uber and Airbnb and many other aspects of the digitization of our culture and technology, who would say, who is making the choice? If it's somebody who's totally disconnected, who doesn't understand the technology, who's 10 steps behind, they shouldn't be setting up rules that constrict the advance of technology.
Rachel, I'm curious, who in Congress has a criminal record?
Quite a few people. I don't have the list off the top of my hand, but some of them do. For, you know, it might be white-collar crime, but it's not a clean bunch.
I think we need to be forgiving on every front. I don't necessarily have a problem with cab drivers, for example, being allowed to drive if they've come out of jail. But we need to be clear about it. Let me just give you one anecdotal story. I was in Detroit a couple of months ago, and every time I sit in the back of a cab drivers always ask me the same thing. They ask me what I do. I say tech. And the first thing he says, oh, Uber, either they're on Uber's side or they're not. And this guy told me a story. He has, as an African-American small business entrepreneur, he had about 5 cabs. He was running a good business. He's very opposed to Uber, by the way. He saw Uber as sweeping him away, like so many other small businesses, why Uber is valued at $40 billion. It's great for the investors of Uber and the tiny groups of people who work for Uber, but not for the thousands of other entrepreneurs out there. But he told me a story of his brother-in-law who just came out of jail. He'd served 10 years for manslaughter. And the laws exist so that this guy cannot drive a traditional cab, but he could drive an Uber cab. Now, that's the kind of regulation that we need. There was an awful case in India a couple of weeks ago in which an Indian cab driver raped a woman. He had a long sexual criminal record. These are exactly the kind of things that people should be checked into. The same is true of the way in which Uber drivers, more and more cases of Uber drivers mistreating their passengers. We need defenses against that. So I'm not saying that nobody should be allowed to be an Uber driver, but this new economy needs to be accountable to the same regulations as the old economy, both in terms of fairness, in terms of giving the old economy a chance to survive. Look how the new economy destroyed the record business. I write about this in some detail in my book, but it hasn't really replaced it with a coherent new music recorded music industry. And I fear the same in all these industries. You know, we started in media. We started with Napster. We started with Amazon. We started with Yahoo and Google. And now this revolution is sweeping across every industry, from transportation to healthcare to education to energy. And everybody out there should be worried about this. Everyone's job is vulnerable. It's not just people who work in bookstores. It's not just musicians or journalists. Everyone is vulnerable to this new tsunami that is sweeping through our economy.
Well, with that, let's go now to Ricardo in Novato. Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
Good morning to both of you and to the author. I thank you eminently for producing a book which emphasizes the backside and the dark side, the underbelly of the internet. I have thought of this at the beginning as something as looking into the seven deadly sins and transposing it on the internet. At the beginning, it was a shiny new method for education and worldwide embodiment of a higher norm for everyone to raise all ships consciously and intellectually, but it's failed. And I can mention that from the beginning just with DARPA, Defense Advanced Research Programs Agency or Projects Agency, and the military and what their idea was. You mentioned Bismarck earlier. It sure is Bismarck when you walk into the deliverance of mass trolling by the governments of the world. When you mentioned Edward Snowden, it is very true. You'll get your Bismarck. You have Big Brother in that name, and you have to pick and choose who you think is Big Brother throughout the world and all your nations. You might wish better for another type of system very soon.
You've got a lot there going, Ricardo. Any comment you want to make on that, Andrew King?
Well, thank you, Ricardo. I hope you'll have the opportunity to read my book. I think the issue of failure is an important one. It's one that I dedicate an entire chapter to. There's an irony here also, of course, because in Silicon Valley, we have what I call the cult of failure. The more successful you are, the wealthier you are, the more you boast about your failure. So you have wealthy tech magnates like Tim O'Reilly from Sebastopol who make speeches about how I failed and were encouraged to fail. And venture capitalists say, you know, we only invest in failures and to succeed, you have to fail. But of course, this is the home of success. And the only people who really idealize failure are the successes. The rest of us are really failing. And failure, when it comes to unemployment or poverty or alienation or bullying online, is extremely painful. So I absolutely agree with what Ricardo says. I think it is what I call in the book an epic fail. It doesn't mean it can't succeed. But at the moment, we've had almost 50 years of the internet. The idea of the internet was born in 1966 through DARPA. The first computer-to-computer communication was in 1969. The web was created in 1989. We're celebrating its 25th anniversary now. It's grown up. It's an adolescent. It's time for us to judge it. And I think overall, it's not a success. It's a failure.
Do you think that that has something to do with the caliber, the broad range of people who are on the internet now? I'm thinking in the beginning, even though it was a DARPA program, a program born of the U.S. military, it was populated for the most part by scientists who, you know, had a kind of collegial approach with each other and big dreams for what the internet might become in its best possible manifestation. But now it's all of us, and it's a motley crew.
Yeah, I don't know, Rachel, if it's actually all of us yet. I mean, we haven't actually seen anything yet. I mean, at the moment, I think there's about 4 billion of us online. But by one of my chapters takes place at Ericsson, the big Swedish telecommunications company, who have about as much, you know, they build the backbone. They understand how the network society works better than anyone. And they predict by 2020, there'll be, I think, 50 billion intelligent devices. And by the mid-2020s, everyone practically in the world, the only people who won't be online or on the network, whatever you want to call it, will be the super rich and the incredibly poor. But everybody else is going to be on it. So I think in terms of cultural, social, economic upheaval, we're just at the beginning of this thing.
Where do you see it going next?
It can go in one or several different ways. I think we can continue along this path of idealizing libertarianism, of not having rules, of turning it into a kind of casino-like economy where a tiny group of people make billions of dollars. Or we can try and reinvent the economy, rethink how we use it, regulate it a bit more responsibly so that we can share in its wealth and share in its benefits. But I think we have to regulate ourselves. We can't just rely on government. We need companies to regulate, and we're seeing some examples of that, for example, when it comes to fighting against piracy, where I use some examples in the book of tech companies and police forces and ISPs and credit card companies working together to confront the organized crime now that's behind piracy. But we need to self-regulate. We need to know as parents, as teachers, we need to know how much we use this thing. Because, of course, there is also, I don't get that much into this, a lot of other good books on this, but there's something extremely addictive about the digital world, which means that we need self-regulation. We can't just rely on government.
And as you say, it seems like that's already happening. We were mentioning Uber earlier. You know, you have state attorneys general rising to the fore. Airbnb has caused local regulators to get in on the act. And also people are turning to police departments these days and saying, well, let's see how you're planning to use that technology.
I think there's one area, you're right, and I think that I hope that continues. It's hard to tell. I think one of the troubling things is the resources that a company like Uber has. I mean, a company that's a startup that's under fire shouldn't really be valued at $40 billion. It's being backed by huge banks now, and it's harder and harder to distinguish Wall Street from Silicon Valley. But I would say there's one area that we need to seriously rethink, which is the free economy. We need to rethink the business models of companies like Google and Facebook, which give out their products for free and have turned us into the product.
We're talking about whether the internet is a net positive with author Andrew Keen. Is it a net positive, an epic failure, something in between? What do you think? Call us at 866-733-6786. You can also email us at forum@KQED or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and add your comments and questions online. We'll be back in just a moment. This is Forum on KQED Public Radio. I'm Rachel Miro. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Rachel Miro in conversation this hour with Andrew Keen, talking about the internet as a force for good, evil, and everything in between. Give us a call if you're listening. We'd like you to join the conversation, 866-733-6786. You can also email us, and I'm going to give the full address now, forum@kqed.org. Another reminder that we are, in many ways, a nonprofit, relying on your donations along with things like grant funding. Arthur writes in, it appears to me that some of the effects Mr. Keene attributes to the internet are more properly attributed to free trade and U.S. laissez-faire tax and trade policies. Outsourcing, which became noticeable during the Reagan administration, but that's not the only one to encourage it. The WTO created without labor standards or environmental protection rules. These can't easily be added now. China was allowed to join the WTO without respect to its, respect of intellectual property rights thereof or lack thereof. Walmart required its suppliers to develop and implement a plan to move production to China. He goes on and on, but basically he's talking about the globalization of the labor market, the difficulty of imposing standards. This does seem to be a larger story that we're experiencing that was happening before there was an internet.
This was Arthur, right?
Yes.
I think that's a very good point. I'm very careful in the book not to treat the internet in sort of Aristotelian terms as the first mover. I never argue that poverty or unemployment or inequality or alienation or bullying or anything else can be caused entirely on the internet. I think the internet now is so interwoven into our lives, into our economy, into our culture, that it's increasingly hard to separate cause and effect. What I would say in response to Arthur's extremely intelligent, I think, remarks is that the internet is compounding many of those forces. So even if Berners-Lee hadn't invented the web in 1989, even if there hadn't been an internet, we would still have the very forces, the disappearance of the middle, the extremes of wealth and poverty. But I would say that it's compounding those things and creating a digital economy which reflects, I think, some of the most troubling aspects of what Arthur is talking about. And I think it's this perfectly free economy, this libertarian ideal of a market which should be unregulated, which we need to examine in terms of the internet. That's one of the key intellectual challenges. Should we allow an unregulated market, for example, that sweeps through jobs? What happens as technology makes people more and more unemployed? What happens if we have an increasingly robot-centric economy? At what point do we begin to regulate and legislate?
And I suppose a lot of that regulation can be self-regulation. If I purchase my tube socks at Walmart, as Arthur was talking about, or Amazon, I'm not really looking at why those tube socks are so cheap, but I can make the choice as a consumer to seek out socially conscious tube socks.
Socially conscious tube socks.
Yes.
It's a new business for any internet entrepreneur. You can make
$1 billion. Yeah, if you want to include me in the business proposal, I'm game.
Seriously, Rachel, I think you're absolutely right. I think Amazon is a good example. We all use Amazon. I use it. I'm not, it's rather like pornography. We all use it, even if we're slightly embarrassed by it. But we need to examine what the implications are of Amazon. So in the book, I get into some of the labor policies of Amazon, the way in which they don't allow their workers to unionize, the reality of what working conditions are like in these Amazon distribution centers, which are horrifying. I mean, they're not as bad as 19th century factories, but they are pretty dehumanizing. And I think that we need to acknowledge that and think through some of the implications. I think the other thing in a broader sense, which I'm troubled with, is I talked about the cult of failure, the cult of the consumer. Jeff Bezos, who's very brilliant, I have a great deal of admiration for him, but he has created this cult of the consumer. He's created this idea that whatever the consumer wants is good. And the problem with that is twofold. Firstly, we're not just consumers, we're also citizens, and often those two are in contradiction. But secondly, when consumers are given everything they want, great prices, great service on a product like Amazon, workers lose out. So this fetishization of the consumer and, of course, of consumption is a very problematic aspect of our digital economy.
We're talking with Andrew Keene about his new book, The Internet is Not the Answer. Diane writes, do you think that the problems are innate to the structure of the internet and that the medium itself limits the solutions? One problem is being anonymous, encourages poor behavior. Another is being sedentary.
Yeah, anonymity is something I get into in my first book. I wrote that anonymity was really problematic and was lending itself to uncivil behavior. We treat each other very badly. We're rude to one another. And my second book, Digital Vertigo, was all about the prying nature of social media. So there's only one thing worse than anonymity, and that's absence of anonymity. When you talk about the structure of the internet, that's a tricky thing, because the internet is a set of protocols. It's something that can be changed. I get into some detail about that. What I argue in the book is that people idealize the notion of the structure of the internet because it was all edge. It had no center. It was built by engineers who purposely avoided hierarchies and the absence of the center. But the unintended consequences, the ironic unintended consequences of this centerless internet are dominant edge companies like Google. So the idea of restructuring it so there's no center, where everything is edge, doesn't necessarily lead to the conclusions that one might want or would expect.
Let's turn to the phones now. And Mensur in San Francisco.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. How are you?
Well, thank you. I just want to really say thank you for writing this book. I woke up and heard that you were talking about Uber, and I was really excited. I drove Uber for about a year, and one of the many things that I wanted to thank you for was thinking about the worker, because we live like in chronic stress of being deactivated or fired. When you go below a 4.7 out of 5 stars, you're eliminated from Uber. And just like after I spent almost $20,000 on the car, just having to worry, like, my job could come to an end at any moment, you know? So that's all.
Great point, Mensur. And it works both ways, because, of course, Uber now is Uber structure allows drivers to grade passengers. Who wants to be graded as a passenger? And I think Mensur's point is an extremely important one, where drivers have no security. In the old economy, drivers had more security. I'm not idealizing the old economy. I've ridden in many awful cabs by very rude and dishonest cab drivers. And I think that the Uber revolution should be the wake-up call to cab companies to improve their services. So certainly it wasn't ideal in any way. But I think this new economy where drivers have absolutely no security, where they're almost forced into putting large amounts of money down for new cars, and then, as Mensur says, are very vulnerable, have no job security, I think that is a troubling aspect of this new economy. I write about in the book a new class of people called the precariat. These are how we're working. And I think a company like TaskRabbit online, where we are employed by the hour, this new economy of a precariat class, not a proletariat, but a precariat, a class of people who are employed by the hour on networks like Uber or Airbnb and TaskRabbit is very, very troubling. And again, we can't blame the internet for this. The idea of even blaming the internet, it's a set of protocols, is absurd. But what we can be troubled with is the way in which this platform is enabling this new world of insecurity, I wouldn't say mass exploitation, but certainly an economy which I think most of us don't want, an economy without regulation, without job security, where anyone can be fired if they get a bad grade, a bad review by customers. And of course, as much of what's been going on with Yelp recently shows, a lot of the customer reviews are themselves corrupt. So who's to say that if you have an angry ex-boyfriend or girlfriend and you're driving an Uber cab, who's to say that that bad review won't come from someone who has a grudge against you? And of course, what Uber and all these other networks have done away with is the curator, the middleman, the person who can actually check, is that a true review? Did the driver really behave badly?
But there's been cheating since the beginning of time. I'm thinking of that Norman Rockwell cartoon, you know, with the butchers or the grocers, you know. He's pressing a finger down on the scale to increase the price of what the customer has to pay, and she's got a finger underneath it pressing up. I mean, I suppose the technology just creates a new set of challenges for us to keep each other honest.
Absolutely. And I agree, Rachel, where, you know, we know from America, from what Madison said, we are not angels. That's why we need government. And because we're not angels, we need curators. We need editors like yourself. We need people checking the rules. And the problem with this new economy is it's trying to sweep away the curators. That's why they fetishize this idea of disintermediation, which everyone says is a good thing because you have fewer people to pay. But of course, it isn't a good thing. It lends itself to more corruption. We're not angels. And in this world, we're behaving less and less like angels.
So you don't seem to believe in the intelligence of the crowd.
I don't believe in the intelligence of the crowd. James Surowiecki, who I have a great deal of respect for, he wrote a book called The Wisdom of the Crowd. And actually, I have an interview show. I just interviewed James. I think his book is excellent. But I think collectively, the dark side of the wisdom of the crowd is the bullying mob. The dark side of the so-called wisdom of the crowd is groups of people who rampage through cyberspace, stalking people, going after people. And the problem with our internet culture is not only do we have an increasingly mob-like culture when it comes to politics, but also we have less and less of a kind of institutionalized memory. We're living in this collective present. So the mob is like a pack of out-of-control elephants running around in circles, trampling everything, and not remembering where they've been or where they're going.
But isn't that on us? I mean, it's my choice whether I choose to, watch mindless cat videos when I go home tonight or, explore the Renaissance Italian art world. Everything is at my fingertips. I can choose to go high rather than low.
That's a fair point, Rachel, and I'm careful in the book. I'm not saying everyone should go online and read Shakespeare. I'm not saying everyone should go online and listen to NPR.
But it's there and more accessible than it ever was before.
It's accessible, and as I say in the book, there's a great deal of quality content. I have a grudging admiration for Wikipedia. I think in some ways it's unreliable. I think it does reflect the best of us, a very generous spirit. Having said all that, though, what troubles me about this new world, whether it's we're looking at cat videos or reading Wikipedia or listening to NPR, is that it's not a viable economy. People like yourself, professional journalists, are struggling in this world. Professional musicians, professional photographers, professional writers. We're not successfully monetizing this economy. In the 90s, when I got into this, we were all promised a kind of a long tail, that everyone would be a writer or a poet or a photographer, a musician. Everyone would be able to sell their stuff. But the problem with the way in which this economy, so-called economy, has unfolded is it's less and less able to support professional creative people. Again, we can't blame the internet for this. It's one of the ironies. And I think one of the most troubling aspects, as I said before the break, is this free economy. We take everything for granted. We think everything should be free, which is one of the reasons for the scourge of piracy. We're not willing to pay for content, which means that we're more and more reliant on advertising, which turns us into the product. And at the same time, really talented creative people, for the most part, are struggling. There's always the case of the 16-year-old with 5 million YouTube followers who's earned a few million dollars. That's the new blockbuster economy. But we're seeing the disappearance of the middle. And again, not just the internet. We're seeing the disappearance of the middle across the economic spectrum. But the internet is compounding that destruction of the middle.
Well, you've gone some way to answering this question, but I'll put it forward anyway because I think there's more meat on these bones. Fernando says, Mr. Keene, please explain how does the bigger wealth of entrepreneurs who sell successful products make anyone else poorer? Wealth comes from satisfying consumers who willfully exchange something of lesser value, their money, for satisfactors that make them happier. Is that not good? Regulations create monopolies. They disable small players to compete with bigger ones. It is really that simple.
I don't agree with Fernando on your last point. I don't agree that regulations create monopolies. Regulations fight against monopolies. So many of the regulations at the end of the 19th century were there to destroy the monopolies of companies like Standard Oil. We had the regulations which forced Microsoft to become less of a monopoly. We never would have got Google without a lot of the antitrust stuff against Microsoft in the 90s. So I would strongly argue that regulation is a friend of competition rather than the reverse.
Or can be a friend of competition.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not suggesting some sort of Stalinist imposition where every company gets regulated. No one's in favor of that. I'm very careful. I'm very calibrated. In terms of his first question about the success of entrepreneurs, use the example of Amazon. Again, Amazon's a great company. It's very, very reliable, wonderful service, great selection. But if you look at the rise of Amazon and the crisis of independent bookstores, it's clear that the success of Amazon has come at the cost of, for the most part, the destruction of an independent bookstore economy. So more and more independent bookstores have gone out of business. They find it increasingly hard to compete on price. So I think Fernando is wrong. I'm not against people being rewarded for hard work and for innovation. And I think Jeff Bezos is an absolute genius. He's one of the most remarkable men of his generation. I think actually after Steve Jobs, he's the most remarkable of all our tech entrepreneurs. But that doesn't mean that we shouldn't equate his rise and success with the collapse, for example, of the independent bookstore sector.
Stella asks, the printing press caused the scribes to lose their jobs. Was the printing press an epic fail?
That's a great question, Stella. The printing press is an epic fail. I've got a sort of a friend or a friendly enemy called Jeff Jarvis, who is always arguing with me and saying, asking those kinds of questions. What I would say is that the invention of the printing press is as epic a change as the invention of digital media. And what I would also say is it's taken 500 years for the printing press to kind of work itself out. At the beginning, the printing press didn't necessarily benefit the writer. We had the emergence of a commercial publishing sphere only in the late 19th and 20th century. So the jury is still undecided on the upside and downside of the printing press. I think Stella's point is a good one in the sense that what the printing press did was democratize information. It took the monopoly away from the old priest caste. And personally, I think that was a good thing, although we should also remember that the printing press was both the cause and effect of the Reformation. And out of the Reformation, we had 100 years of incredibly bloody war. We had Luther and Calvin, and we had endless civil war, and we had a huge debate that's gone on for centuries about the role of authority in the Catholic Church and the role of the priest and of the local religious figure. So we're seeing the same sort of impact in terms of the trauma of the digital revolution on us. Hopefully it won't result in actual war.
One of the things that we've as a society come to appreciate through the advance of the internet is the idea of iterative change. Not so much, you know, the big bold stroke, but the little changes, the little fixes that make something better and perhaps ultimately collectively become big change. Are there any positive things you would suggest to turn our eyes towards solutions with this that might make things just a little bit better in the next 5 years?
Well, I would like to see more experiments with business models. I think that, as I said before, we need to rethink the core business model. Ethan Zuckerman of Harvard University of the Berkman Center, one of the early enthusiasts of the internet, talks about the free model where we rely more and more on advertising as being the original sin of the internet, which causes all the other problems. I'd like to see, hopefully, entrepreneurs listening to this, entrepreneurs in Silicon Valley, rethinking business models, getting people to pay for their product, for their content, but at the same time being guaranteed privacy, being guaranteed that their data won't be used to exploit them or transform them into products. So I think that's one area where we really need there may be some iterative opportunities. The other area, I think, is that the zeitgeist is changing. Many of the examples I use in the book are from Silicon Valley entrepreneurs or prominent venture capitalists who are beginning to recognize this has gone wrong. I really respect somebody like Marc Andreessen, for example. He figures centrally in the book because he was the guy who did Netscape. He was the kid who was the first internet sort of millionaire, multimillionaire. But he has come out. He's a very powerful VC in Silicon Valley, runs probably the most powerful venture capitalist company. He's refused to invest in these new secret kind of apps where dominated by anonymity, which lend themselves to bullying. So I would commend him. I would commend Fred Wilson, the New York investor, who talks more and more critically about the monopoly, the monopoly-like nature of the economy. And I think more and more people who have historically been critical of Work Like Mine are actually recognizing that there's a big problem. So I think those kind of people, it's insiders who can help with the iterative process. I'm less sympathetic, you know, to stoning Google buses and that sort of thing. I don't think that's a solution.
Let's hit the phones now and go to Peter in San Francisco.
Yes, hi. It's Peter Warfield from Library Users Association. One of the things that I'm very glad to hear this program all together, and the book sounds wonderful. One of the things that I think, two things I think happened. One is penetration into unexpected areas. And the other thing that I think is really bad about the Internet often is breaking prior expectations. So there is an opportunity actually for local people to oppose, for example, the library, San Francisco Public Library's current plan to install a supposed catalog improvement, which also is going to incorporate social media, and is so bad on privacy that the Library Commission is being asked basically to trash the existing privacy policy that the library has in place. Also, it's called BiblioCommons, and it sounds like a commons where people can talk freely. In fact, it's unmitigated control by the corporate entity. If three people flag a comment, it will be removed basically at the sole discretion of the company.
Well, Peter, this sounds like a subject for a whole other hour of forum. If I could I ask you to go to our webpage and post links for people to explore the topic further?
LibraryUsers2004@yahoo.com for more information.
All right. Thank you.
Can I respond to one thing? I think Peter's point is a really important one, because what these companies, and I think particularly Facebook, have done is present their product as a public utility. They market it as something which is designed for us, that they're doing it on our behalf to improve humanity. So, for example, the reform that Peter talks about enables everyone in the libraries to use social media. What they forget is these companies are actually profiting from our data. So I think it's really important to have people like Peter out there who are critical or able to say, look, this is marketing. What's really happening is these companies are profiting from us.
I guess you could also say, too, that we need to sort of keep our eyes open about the increased prevalence of what are called walled gardens, platforms, whether they're on the web or on the mobile, where you're just in one company's little world. You're not really getting the broader picture, especially when this concerns, for instance, researching information that is important to personal or scientific or political value.
Yes and no, Rachel. On the one hand, you're absolutely right, of course. Walled gardens are troubling if they're not acknowledged as walled gardens. So Facebook, which is a walled garden, presents itself as the universal web, and it isn't. It's its own little walled garden, and it's making billions of dollars from it. A successful walled garden, but a walled garden nonetheless. However, I would have one warning about what you're saying, because I'm suspect that in that observation is the idea that there could be something that isn't a walled garden, this ideal of this open internet where there are no walled gardens. And I would argue that walled gardens are in the nature of things, that one of the problems with the internet, it was dreamt up by the idealists who said we could have this open place where everyone would behave themselves. And, of course, that's not what happened. So what we need are walled gardens like we have in the world, where we walk around the cities and everyone has their property. What we need is a regulated world of walled gardens rather than an unregulated one where the owners of the biggest walled gardens present themselves as some sort of universal transparent place, which is really just a lie.
I think we have time for at least one more call. Rob in San Francisco.
Good morning, and thank you for having me on. I agree with so many things, I don't even know where to start. It really does feel like we're kind of in that transition between knowing what our problem is and figuring out a solution. It's like we are a gold rush town at its beginnings, and there's no laws in place, and we need to develop a city government and rules that everybody has to follow so that people aren't stealing from each other, people aren't shooting each other. And we need to mature this Internet, but it's going to take our politicians that aren't being bought off by a lot of these big players to be able to have the guts to make the new rules. And the Teddy Roosevelt thing was a great analogy to what has happened. And I just wonder if we're going to be able to pull this off for everybody's good.
Andrew Keene?
Great point, Raoul. I have to admit I'm rather embarrassed that everyone's agreeing with me. I'm used to people telling me that I'm wrong. So maybe I've done something wrong with this book. Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, I think we have to be careful about assuming all politicians are corrupt. One of the things that we need to remind ourselves is if we dismiss politicians, if we think they're all corrupt, then there's nothing else. It's either the government or its rules. There's no third force. What I would say is that there is a troubling intimacy, I think, between the current Obama administration and Silicon Valley. And I hope in the next election there'll be a more robust and serious discussion about the way in which Silicon Valley in some ways is becoming the new Wall Street. And it needs to be critically examined. So not only in terms of fundraising, but when you see in the Obama administration, many ex-Google employees, for example, are slipping in and out of the administration. I think we need to be critical about that and see what's really happening.
Andrew Keene, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you. That was really fun.
We've been talking with Andrew Keene, author of The Internet is Not the Answer. You've been listening to Forum on KQED Public Radio. I'm Rachel Miro.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.